It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. A chef joins us to talk about corn, growing it, eating it, and a variety of recipes that go beyond boiling and grilling. First, a report from ACLU Wisconsin finds that in the last decade, partnerships between local law enforcement and the federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement have grown here in the state, leading to more undocumented immigrants being deported right out of jail or prison. The report finds this has been the case even for undocumented immigrants who have committed non-violent crimes, like driving without a license. Between 2006 and 2020, ICE tried to deport over 12,000 immigrants from jails or prisons around the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think local law enforcement should cooperate with ICE or Immigration and Customs Enforcement? Do you want to see the Sheriff's Department or municipal police in your area cooperate with federal immigration officials? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tim Muth is a staff attorney for ACLU Wisconsin and principal author of the report on ICE partnerships with local law enforcement. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate your interest in this topic.
What did you set out to examine in this report?
What we were looking at is the extent of collaboration between local county sheriffs across the state and ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And what we found is that there continue to be a broad swath of sheriffs who are willing and able to collaborate with ICE in immigration enforcement and deporting people out of our communities across the state.
Paint us a picture of what that cooperation might look like in one of the county sheriff's departments that cooperates with ICE.
Sure. There's different kinds of ways that sheriff's departments collaborate. One is to hold immigrants for up to 48 hours, if they're asked to, by ICE after they should have been released out of the jail, maybe because they paid their bail or they finished their sentence. A second way is entering into agreements called a 287G agreement, because that's the section of the immigration law that it's named after. And that's a kind of a partnership where actually some of the jail personnel are authorized to act as agents of ICE. A third way that we found is that a local sheriff may accept money under a federal grant process in return for identifying undocumented immigrants who they have held in their jail. And then we also just find sheriffs who cooperate informally with ICE. One county in particular we found would regularly just email ICE every time somebody who was born outside of the United States was booked into the jail and ask ICE if they were interested in that person.
And let's talk about the people we're talking about who might be, you know, might come to ICE attention under this. There's a wide range of people born in other countries here in Wisconsin. To what extent are we talking about people who are completely undocumented versus people with various kinds of legal status?
It certainly varies very much from county to county, but at least some of the counties have a practice of everybody who is born outside of the United States, they identify to ICE. So that person might be a naturalized citizen. They might actually be a U.S. citizen, or they might be a dreamer and have DACA status in the country. Or they might be a completely undocumented person who has been living under the radar, so to speak, in the country for a number of years.
And we've got 72 counties in Wisconsin. How common are these various kinds of cooperation, formal and informal?
So very few counties, only about five, have actual formal policies that say they will not hold people for an extra 48 hours if ICE asks for it. As many as 30 counties are receiving money under this federal grant program. for identifying undocumented persons who they have held in their jail. We believe that, one of the problems is that the vast majority of the counties really have little in the way of formal policy that guides their interactions with immigration enforcement.
We're talking to Tim Muth, staff attorney for ACLU Wisconsin, author, lead author of a new report looking at cooperation between law enforcement, sheriff's offices in particular here in Wisconsin, and immigration and customs enforcement, or ICE. You can join in if you have a thought or a question or maybe an experience at 800-642-1234. Tim, people might be hearing this and thinking, well, local police departments and sheriff's offices cooperate with federal authorities all the time. If people are here under illegal circumstances, or they've committed some kind of infraction that might violate the terms of their legal status here, what's the problem?
So there are a couple of things. One is just having your local sheriff's department be seen as a partner or a collaborator with ICE makes local communities of immigrants fearful and less likely to interact with local sheriff's departments on all sorts of basis. But the other thing is, it's important to realize that being in the country without authorization isn't necessarily a crime. Somebody may not have legal authorization to stay here, but that doesn't mean that they have actually committed a criminal offense. Removing somebody from the country is a civil proceeding, not a criminal proceeding in most cases. And in Wisconsin, our law enforcement authorities are supposed to work on criminal matters and keeping our communities safe. Our basic position is leave federal immigration enforcement to federal authorities, and local authorities should focus on the particular things needed to keep our community safe.
Did you find some county sheriff's departments that were more or less doing that, that had a more or less formal policy that says, yeah, we're not going to make these kind of referrals to ICE?
Yes, Milwaukee County, for example, adopted a policy of not holding people for 48 hours when ICE requested, and also reducing the amount of information they shared with ICE. They do not participate in the grant program that shares information about people held in the jail with ICE. And we see a definite correlation between the amount of activity by ICE in Milwaukee County in terms of the size of its population to say, a Door County that during the time up until Sheriff Barrett took office was receiving more money than any other county, quite a bit more money than any other county, for sharing information with ICE. So there's a wide variation across the state.
Who is the decider in all these cases? Is it the elected sheriff in a county? Is there oversight from county boards of supervisors or county executives? Who makes the call on these decisions?
It's very much the local sheriff. Local sheriffs are elected directly, and this is an election year for all the sheriffs across the state. And that was one of the reasons we wanted to issue this report, so that citizens can be actively asking sheriffs who are campaigning for office what their policies are, and how they might change those policies if elected.
And what are you asking counties to do, sheriff's offices to do, to review their current policies and consider changes?
We have several suggested things that we would call for sheriffs to do. They need to stop the illegal holding people for 48 hours after an ICE request. any sheriff who has entered into a 287G agreement should end that agreement. They should enact policies that say that we're not going to share information with ICE unless we're legally required to. If there are legal requirements, certainly the sheriff's department should still be sharing, but for volunteering information with ICE should be a policy which is prohibited within a sheriff's department. And then they should end participation in the grant program that gives them money in return for sharing information about undocumented persons held in the jail.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tim Muth is a volunteer staff attorney for ACLU Wisconsin. He talked to us about a report he authored detailing an increase in partnerships between ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and local law enforcement in Wisconsin, particularly sheriff's departments. Next, we'll talk to an immigration lawyer about how these partnerships affect immigrants living in Wisconsin and how they differ from policies in the past. You can still join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or members of your family immigrants? Do you have an experience to share, thoughts on how this all works? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about collaboration between local law enforcement in Wisconsin, sheriff's departments in particular, and Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement, or ICE. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions about that report we just heard about from ACLU Wisconsin. Aaron Barbato joins us now, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you for covering this topic.
Yeah, from what we've heard about that ACLU Wisconsin report, is this any surprise to you? Have you seen an increase in this kind of local law enforcement, federal immigration enforcement cooperation over the years?
Yeah, over the years, the cooperation decreased under the Obama administration, but then increased again under the Trump administration. So I was a bit surprised to learn that additional counties in Wisconsin have entered into this agreement while surrounding states have no agreements, 287G agreements at all.
How do these kind of agreements affect people if they come into contact with law enforcement, immigrants who come into contact with law enforcement?
Well, I think if someone comes into contact with law enforcement and they are undocumented, there's a good chance that they could be placed into deportation proceedings and in immigrant detention, which is basically just a jail. The point of 287G and of ICE's role is to ensure that criminal aliens, the words that they use as criminal aliens, are being a high priority. But what we've seen through studies of this 287G programs is the majority of people that are being picked up in this situation are non-criminals or people with very little criminal background.
There's a lot of discretion, as we just heard, from state to state and from county to county, even within Wisconsin. How much variation do you see?
We see a lot of variation. It depends on my clients that I have who may not have the ability to drive, not because they don't want a driver's license, but simply because they're undocumented and they can't yet obtain a driver's license. There are many places in Wisconsin that I fear for them to be driving in a car, even a passenger in the car, because they may be targeted in one of these areas, which is very concerning and not the way that people in the United States should have to live.
Now, if somebody's a passenger in a car, I guess why would their immigration status come up?
Well, hopefully it wouldn't, but there may be a way for the law enforcement to investigate the person that is a passenger in the car and the person who's driving. So no one is necessarily protected in that situation.
Talking to Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School, looking at local law enforcement, how they might, in some cases, cooperate with federal immigration enforcement, how that affects people here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Roberto is with us in Hilbert. Roberto, hi.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to share this when I heard the topic today. about, I'm thinking about 6-7 years ago, I believe they're always looking for excuses. And sometimes I don't want to talk like generalizing, right? But I got pulled over with the excuse somebody says, or the officer says, that they called, they had a call that somebody was passing. I was driving, obviously. Somebody was passing and passing on double lane or hills and stuff like that. And they were erratically like driving really fast or stuff like that, right? So which I'm like, officer, I said, how fast was I going when you pulled me over? He goes, that's not my question. I'm like, officer, I'm just trying to tell you that I follow the rules. But anyways, he gave me a ticket. And it's just sometimes it gets you upset. But we Hispanics live, I want to put that behind, because it poisons your blood when you keep on thinking about that, right? But you can feel it. You can feel it that you're always under a shadow. You're always thinking, is it going to get better? Am I going to be okay today? And it's just so many things that go on that makes you think that you're always under something, under like hiding. Because that system makes you feel like a second class citizen, how you're treated. And it is true. You're treated really like you don't belong here. That's how you get certain
Roberto, thanks.
Attitude.
I got you. Thanks for the call, Roberto. Aaron, I think Roberto feeling profiled in his daily life.
Yeah, and I think that is a way that a lot of my clients feel, especially in counties where there are 287G agreements. But, you know, you worry about people, you know, we represent a lot of people who are survivors of serious crimes. And if they're in an area where there's a 287G agreement, they might have a fear of reporting that crime for fear that they will be placed into deportation proceedings. And that's what the law enforcement will focus on, not the perpetrator who committed the crime against them. And people live in fear, and they shouldn't have to.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Jacob in Eau Claire. Jacob, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Good. My question is this. I'm just a former, I got about 10 years of law enforcement under my belt in the U.S. military, as well as civilians in the U.S. And I'm all for immigrants coming from this country that are, you know, here for the right reasons, you know, for integrating into society and doing good for this country and being productive citizens. But my question is this. I just heard lawyers, I think, on the program say, you know, too many people that are getting caught up in this web they have either a minor criminal record or no criminal record at all. I mean, I understand if people don't have a criminal record, and, you know, that's fine. I mean, if we're saying that, you know, they entered the country under, you know, whatever circumstance, you know, we could probably handle that and adjudicate that in some other manner. But if somebody, let's say, comes into this country from Switzerland, let's say, and then gets in a car drunk and commits vehicular manslaughter, I'm pretty sure they're going to end up back in their own country, you know, or they're going to be in prison here. So, you know, the thing is, I guess my question is, why isn't there a way we can better adjudicate whether if someone has a criminal background or even a medium to major one, go after those people, you know, and make a distinction that the public can readily trust.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Aaron, yeah, is there a way that we can have this kind of cooperation maybe between local law enforcement and ICE when, as Jacob says, a substantial crime is committed?
Well, that already occurs. There are different agreements that there are times that local law enforcement needs to contact ICE based on the law, and especially when there is something serious similar to the situation that he may be presenting. But ICE has a job, and immigration laws are federal. And the studies seem to show that ICE is the best person or the best people to enforce those policies and those laws, while local law enforcement should focus on the laws that they're in charge of on a local or state level.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. James joins us next in Wautoma. James, hi.
Hi, thank you. My point is, might we Oh, I'm all for the people who want to come here and better their lives. And so, but if we want to get people who maybe aren't supposed to be here, go after the companies that hire them, such as restaurants, construction workers, farms and stuff, instead of individuals.
James, thanks for that call. We don't have too much time left, James. Aaron, that's a common suggestion. Go after the people who are hiring, knowingly or otherwise, I guess, people who are here without documentation.
Yeah, I mean, that point comes up a lot. I think one thing that we have to recognize is that a lot of our state is supported by undocumented workers, including our dairy farms, and they would fold without this type of labor. And it's not the way that the system should work, but the people who are here working have no other option. There's no legal path for them generally to obtain a work permit or a visa to remain here in the United States. So it's just a very complicated area.
James, thanks for that call. Aaron, in just our last half a minute or so, are there changes you'd like to see at sheriff's departments in particular that might clarify some of these things?
You know, I think the best option would be to terminate 287G agreements in general and allow local law enforcement to communicate with ICE when they're required by law. The studies have shown that the racial profiling is evident in 287G agreements, and that simply needs to end if we want to have safe communities.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. Erin Barbato is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School. She talked to us about how partnerships between local and federal law enforcement affects immigration policy in Wisconsin and beyond. Earlier, we heard about an ACLU Wisconsin report on that issue. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're celebrating sweet corn season here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get a lesson on Wisconsin's lumberjack folklore through history. Now, corn's a big deal in Wisconsin. No surprise, Wisconsin ranks in the top 10 states for corn production, according to a calculation in 2021 by Crop Profit. It's Food Friday. I like corn. I know our next guest likes corn, and maybe you do too. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite way to prepare corn? Do you get excited when sweet corn season is around the corner? Have you been demolishing a lot of it so far this last couple of weeks? Do you have a question about how to cook with it and do maybe more than grilling or boiling? Or is that enough for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elena Terry is the founder and executive director of Wild Berries, a nonprofit she formed in 2018 to keep First Nation food traditions alive and help community members who are dealing with trauma or addiction. She's also a consulting chef with the Intertribal Agriculture Council. Elena, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
All right, last time I talked to you, it wasn't about corn, but we wrapped up by both talking about how excited we are that corn season was coming. What is it you love about sweet corn this time of year?
Oh my goodness, sweet corn this time of year is incredible. I actually just got done drying a full bushel and then an extra couple bags of sweet corn because it's the best thing to pull out in the winter months for soup. And there's so many different varieties. I was really looking forward to starting to see the colored corn come out. And right now it's kind of at the tail end of its green phase, which means it's still a little milky. And then it starts transitioning into these like bright, beautiful, deep colors where you can start processing it differently and storing it and preserving it differently. So yeah, this time is all about corn.
Let's talk about some of the variety because, you know, you go to the farm stand, generally you find the yellow corn or maybe white kernels. Can you talk about the variety that's out there in the world of corn?
Oh my goodness, there's so much variety. if you talk about corn that's used for cornmeal or flour, or if you have sweet corn, or there's popcorn also. I mean, there's a lot of different varieties of corn, even just varieties of sweet corn. I know here where I'm at this summer, I've had candy corn, honey dip sweet corn, bicolored sweet corn. I mean, there's so many. And part of that, you know, it just brings to the diversity and the beauty of this incredible plant and the way it can really be used for so many different purposes. And it has so many different characteristics based on, you know, those different variations.
As I mentioned, part of Wildberry's mission is to keep First Nation food traditions alive. Corn, a big part of those traditions over a huge part of this continent, and I guess South America too, maybe. Could you just talk a little bit about the importance of corn?
Absolutely. Corn has its own role in our culture, in our ceremony, in our households even. And it's so valued. You know, I am a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and Ho-Chunk, there have been certain families who have stewarded specific varieties, say a blue corn or a bronze beauty corn or pure white corn. For hundreds of years, these seeds have been passed down, and they've continued to grow them in their purity, you know, with hand pollinating them to make sure that there's not cross-pollination from outside factors that could change the integrity of the genetics. And, you know, I like to think of it as when we plant this traditional and ancestral corn that, I mean, those seeds really are a life. Any seed is a life. And when you plant it, you're helping it fulfill its destiny to become what it was meant to become. And for us, those different corns that are traditional and ancestral, their destiny is to, you know, serve a purpose to provide space in ceremony in our households and to connect us to our ancestors. So it's very, very important for us to have that corn continue to be grown in those ways.
And Elena, you mentioned earlier today, you dried a bunch of corn. I've never done this. I have, you know, I freeze some that I've grilled. I make corn relishes and things like that. What goes into drying a bushel of corn?
There's a lot of different ways that you could dry it. What I like to do, especially with sweet corn or that milky white green corn that I was talking about, is to parboil it, which means just to bring your water to a boil, to put your corn in there for about 10 minutes or until the color really starts changing. And then you take it out and you take each kernel off of the cob where it's able to maintain its whole shape. And then you can dry it. And it definitely tastes different when you dry it in the sun as opposed to a dehydrator. But I've also found that something like sweet corn, where it does have a higher chance of turning bad quickly because of the sugars that's in it, it's a dehydrator might be the best way to do to dry that corn. But once it's dried, then you can use it for multiple purposes. It's just an incredible thing because when you dry it this way with partially boiling it, it's preserved differently. When we dry it on the cob or on the stalk, we could use those kernels for either seed or for nixtamalization in transforming that corn. When we parboil it, it's more specifically for culinary purposes only.
All right. This was a new word for me, nixtamalization. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a big word. It's a mouthful to try and say, but it's the process of liming the corn or bringing an acidic pH to the corn to help process some of those toxins that are in it and to soften the outside hull of the corn so that the part that you wouldn't digest. And it also releases nutrients that are in there. So it's a crucial process to do when you're transforming corn or preserving it in different ways, or if you're using it to cook with, because without nixtamalization, it can actually be toxic to your body. So, but when you do that process of adding lye or sometimes I think there's a sodium bicarbonate or or something that you can add to it. We use hardwood ash in its purest form. We'll actually have a fire and keep the ash and then, you know, use that until we're through with it, and then use another fire with the sole intention of having that ash to nixtamalize the corn. And so, yeah, it's another part. It's something that you would do if you were, say, making masa, or if you were using fresh tortillas, you might want to nixtamalize your corn right before you do that.
We're talking to Elena Terry on this edition of Food Friday, founder and executive director of Wild Berries. We are cooking with corn, talking about corn traditions, different ways to use it. You could join in with your own favorites, your questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I've often heard you mention, Rob, that you like to make soup.
Oh, yeah.
And I do also. I'm a real soup lover. I feel deprived, actually, if I don't have soup every day. But what I'm calling to tell you is that as opposed to talking about sweet corn right now, what I'm talking about is using 2 cans of creamed corn. If you're going to make potato soup, leek soup, tomato, squash, even chicken noodle, any kind of soup, if you start with 2 cans of creamed corn, there is a richness to that soup that it just improves any soup immeasurably. And I'm thinking that you would like to know that because you're a soup lover as I am.
I love making soup.
It thickens the soup and it riches the taste just tremendously.
Nancy, thank you so much for that advice. And Elena, that reminds me of something you teased last time we were on that I wanted to ask you about today. Grating a corn cob that I think you end up using in soup or creamed corn. Do I remember that right?
Yes, that's a great way to do it. If you have fresh sweet corn and you grate that into a bowl, then you have the corn starch, the sugar, and the texture of that fresh corn. And then what I like to do is start my stock with those cobs, what's remaining, because there's so much flavor in the cobs, and then add basically that raw creamed corn stock to the base that you started, and you can just get an incredible depth of corn flavor there as well.
All right, you grate the corn and then you put the corn cob in the stock whole, is that right?
Yes.
Okay,
and then you can pull that out later, but it's an incredible base to a vegetable stock or any type of soup stock.
Nancy, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Elena Terry, founder and executive director of Wild Berries, about cooking with corn, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite way to grill corn, to boil corn, to cook it off the cob? Favorite things to serve it with or in? Recipes you like to use? Or do you have a question for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow your own? Do you grow heirloom varieties? Definitely love to hear from you. If so, 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Elena Terry, founder and executive director of the nonprofit Wild Berries. Elena's talking to us about different ways to prepare and cook with corn. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a big fan of corn? Do you look forward to sweet corn season each year? Do you have a favorite recipe, a favorite thing, a way you like to use it in your cooking? Do you have a question for our guest? You preserve corn. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Joe is with us in Taylor. Joe, hello.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Joe?
Well, I was wondering what the drying techniques of on the cob versus through the kernels, like if you leave it on the cob or if you just put it out in the sun.
Oh, interesting, Joe. Thanks for the call. So on the cob or off the cob for drying, Elena?
Well, it would depend a little bit on what you wanted your end result to be. You would want to leave it on the cob to dry if you're going to, say, grind that up and use it for cornmeal. Or if you're going to use it for seed, then you'd want it to stay on the cob. if you want to maybe use it for the culinary purposes, then I would say do the parboil and then dry it off of the cob. If you cook it at all, you want to take it off of the cob because that cob is going to hold on to the moisture, and it's going to kind of inhibit the drying process. So if you have it on the cob, then it's kind of kept in its state on the stalk drying. And if you take it off of the stalk and you cook it at all, then you want to take those kernels off of the cob before you dry it.
All right, Joe, happy drying. Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Lou joins us next in Bayfield. Lou, what did you want to bring up?
Hey there. Have you ever tried elote, Mexican street corn? That is the best.
I have, Lou. And I got to say, I just had it in the last few years. I was kind of like hurt and offended because nobody told me about it like decades ago. It's so good. Do you have a favorite way to eat it, or where did you run across it?
Well, my son, one of my adult sons, he says, yeah, Mom, you should try elote, street corn, Mexican street corn. I said, okay, well, let me know how to do it. And since I'm vegan, I use my vegan mayonnaise, Hellman's mayonnaise, and I do it that way. And it works just fine. It tastes the same. And vegan mayonnaise, vegan mayonnaise, Hellman's mayonnaise, and then really any vegan butter. But let your viewer or let your listeners know, you know, how to do it, what the process is. Or do you know how to?
Lou, I've kind of winged it and made up my own street corn. You just cook the corn and then mix it up. I like it with grilled corn, mix it up with, like you say, mayo and lime and spices. And there's lots of different varieties I've seen at restaurants. Elena, do you have any thoughts on elote, Mexican street corn?
It is one of my favorites. I mean, how can you not like that? It's the perfect combination of sweet and salty, creamy, and a little bit of texture. If you use cotija cheese or tajin to add a little bit of extra spice to it. I know some like theirs a little bit spicier, and I've even seen them crunch up flaming hot Cheetos and put those on the outside of the street corn. So people are getting really inventive with how they add flavor and texture to it. But I mean, how you can't go wrong with sweet corn, mayonnaise, butter, cheese, lime, and salt and seasonings.
Yeah, I got to admit, that's something I've intended to do this year and haven't done it so far. But I've got a bunch of grilled corn now in the freezer, so I've got time. Great. That's a great suggestion, Lou. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking about corn with Elena Terry from the group Wild Berries. Back to your calls now. We've got Don with us in Bayfield County. Don, hi.
Hi, Don. Hey, when I was a young lad, all the corn that we used to get was golden yellow corn, and you can't find it anymore. It's all bicolored corn.
Oh, yeah, the yellow and white stuff. I feel like I still run into both, Elena. You go beyond the yellow and white, but have you noticed a long-term trend like Don has seen?
I kind of have seen that there is more bicolored sweet corn, but I also have noticed that there's some incredibly sweet hybrid corn that's been introduced. Like I mentioned, the candy corn or the honey dipped sweet corn. And those are pretty universally yellow. So I think that it just depends on where you're getting it from and who's growing what varieties.
Don, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jonathan joins us now in Madison. Jonathan, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up nixtamalization and talk a little bit more about that, because I think tortillas and masa are probably one of the most integral parts of corn usage. I know we're not in like dry corn season yet, but the uses for masa, from atole to tostadas to tortillas to tamales, it's so versatile. And like atole, for instance, you can actually use fresh masa in like for beverages or soups as a thickening agent, and it creates a really nice viscosity and adds really nice flavor. I just wanted to highlight nixtamalization a little bit more.
Jonathan, you sound like a pro. Do you make your own tortillas and the other things you were talking about?
I actually do, and actually Elena and I are friends through the through the culinary industry. I will say I do own and operate a tortilleria in Madison.
Excellent. Jonathan, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that with us. Yeah, corn, obviously super versatile, Elena. Jonathan mentioning tortillas and a couple other things we haven't gotten into yet.
Yeah, Jonathan is incredible. So if you're in Madison, try and check out his operation down there, because it is so amazing, corn, and it can be transformed into so many different ways. And when you add that process of nixtamalization, you really do open up like this incredible culinary world of flavor and texture and different varying end products. So I think that, you know, the more you talk about it and the more you're able to have access to things that have been hand processed, like the tortillas and stuff that Jonathan does, then the more you're able to appreciate the flavor in its pure form, the way that it was intended to be, you know, tasted. And when you really can taste that corn, it's incredible. And there's such a diversity in the flavor profiles that even each strain of corn provides, let alone the textures or even how long you wait to mill the corn after you nixtamalize it, or if you refrigerate it. I mean, there's so many different ways that you can transform corn that, I mean, it's incredible. And I would just really encourage people to try doing it in a little bit more of diverse ways, or to go and get some of those products that have had that hand care and authenticity incorporated into the preparation of it, because you can't really duplicate that in, you know, mass produced product.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for that call. Okay, I want to stay with nixtamalization a little bit longer here. If I wanted to try it at home, you kind of talked through some of the basics earlier, Elena. You know, not buying any special stuff. Like, what would be the easiest way for me to nixtamalize my corn?
You'd have to start with your product that needs to be nixtamalized. So you would have to get the corn that is dried.
Okay.
Like the whole kernels that are dried. And, you know, I think that for me, I would only want to recommend that you be able to do that on an outdoor fire, you know, open fire, where you soak it and you rinse it and you wash it, and then you add your hardwood ash to the corn in a pot and you cook it until it really does start to pop open. I mean, you can take it to different levels of opening based on what you want your end product to be. So sometimes we partially do it for preservation purposes, and then we finish cooking it when we rehydrate it. And sometimes we completely open it up, grind it for hominy, or to make product like tortillas. So I would probably recommend to see what you wanted to do with your end product, and then take your corn to that stage. And I think the best part is we are entering a time where there will be plenty of corn available if you wanted to, you know, experiment with the process and with what your end result would be, is that now is the time to be able to get the supplies to do that. And like, what an exciting thing to try at home.
All right. Now I want to take things to super basics here, Elena. Grilled or boiled, I'm a butter and salt guy, and that's it. If you're eating corn on the cob, do you have any condiments on it? Straight up, what do you like to do?
So we just had some fresh sweet corn that we grilled up at the Monogan Market in Mackinac City, and they produce maple syrup there. So we mixed maple syrup with real butter and took the fat solids out of the butter and dipped the sweet corn in there as soon as it came off of the grill and finished it with a little sprinkle of salt. And that was incredible. I myself ate, I think I ate 3 ears of my own corn because I was like, oh man, I just wanted to really try a little bit more of it. So I would say that if you like something sweet like that and adding a little bit of sweetness to it, it's always good to add like that fresh lime. There's a reason why it's so popular. That acid gives a nice complement to, you know, the sweetness of the corn. But I think it's really important too to keep the simplicity of the ingredients, especially when it is something as beautiful as corn, and not to overpower it with adding a whole lot, unless of course you're making that elotes, because it's just the perfect bite there.
Elena, we'll leave it there. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and, you know, happy eating with corn. Great conversation with you, as always.
That's Elena Terry, founder and executive director of Wild Berries. You can keep sharing your corn-related favorites and recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Speaking of corn, an image of an ear of corn might make some Wisconsin quarters worth more than 25 cents. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, an online video has been making the rounds about the state-themed Wisconsin U.S. quarter released in 2004. Turns out a number of those quarters were minted with a flaw in the image. Now it shows a cow, some cheese, and an ear of corn. And in the misprinted quarters, the ear of corn has an extra leaf on the side. Okay, it's not the most exciting thing, but that flaw can make the quarter worth extra money. The video highlights a mint condition bad corn quarter selling for $2,000. Don't start spending that money just yet. The price is way down now that people know what they're looking for. Still, it might be worth a quick look through that pocket full of change or bucket of change while you're waiting for your corn to get done. This is Central Time.